GGC and GCC code respectively for the amino acids glycine and alanine, and because of their chemical simplicity, these were formed in greater abundance in the prebiotic world. The assertion that the first code words were assigned to the most common amino acids is nothing if not plausible, and it underlines the fact that the logic of the coding scheme results from physical and chemical laws and their outworkings in nature. Eigen, 1992, page 34. These outworkings are algorithmic sorting processes, which take the probabilities or biases that are due to fundamental laws of physics and produce structures that would otherwise be wildly improbable. As Eigen says, the resulting scheme has a logic. It is not just two things coming together, but an assignment, a system that comes to make sense, and makes sense because, and only because, it works. These very first semantic links are, of course, so utterly simple and local that they hardly count as semantic at all. But we can see a glimmer of reference in them nevertheless. There is a fortuitous wedding of a bit of nucleotide string with a protein fragment that helped directly or indirectly to reproduce it. The loop is closed. And once this semantic assignment system is in place, everything speeds up. Now a fragment of code string can be the code for something, a protein. This creates a new dimension of evaluation because some proteins are better than others at doing catalytic work, and particularly at assisting in the replication process. This raises the stakes. Whereas, at the outset, macro strings could differ only in their self-contained capacity to self-replicate, now they can magnify their differences by creating, and linking their fates to, other, larger structures. Once this feedback loop is created, an arms race ensues. Longer and longer macros compete for the available building blocks to build ever bigger, faster, more effective, but also more expensive, self-replicating systems. Our pointless coin-tossing tournament of luck has transformed itself into a tournament of skill. It has a point, for there is now something for the succession of winners to be better at than just trivially winning the coin toss. And does the new tournament ever work? There are tremendous skill differences between proteins, so there is plenty of room for improvement beyond the minuscule catalytic talents of the proteinoids. In many cases, enzymic catalysis accelerates a reaction by a factor between 1 million and 1,000 million. Wherever such a mechanism has been analyzed quantitatively, the result has been the same. Enzymes are optimal catalysts. Eigen, 1992, page 22. Catalytic work done creates new jobs to be done. So the feedback cycles spread out to encompass more elaborate opportunities for improvement. Whatever task a cell is adapted to, it carries out with optimal efficiency. The blue-green alga, a very early product of evolution, transforms light into chemical energy with an efficiency approaching perfection. Eigen, 1992, page 16. Such optimality cannot be happenstance. It must be the result of a gradual homing-in process of improvement. So, from a set of tiny biases in the initial probabilities and competences of the building blocks, a process of snowballing self-improvement is initiated. 3. The laws of the game of life. This most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being. Isaac Newton, 1726. Passage translated in Elagard, 1956, page 176. The more I examine the universe and study the details of its architecture, the more evidence I find that the universe in some sense must have known that we were coming. Freeman Dyson, 1979, page page 250. It is easy to imagine a world that, though ordered, nevertheless does not possess the right sort of forces or conditions for the emergence of significant depth. Paul Davies, 1992. Fortunately for us, the laws of physics vouchsafe that there are, in the vast space of possible proteins, macromolecules of such breathtaking catalytic virtuosity that they can serve as the active building blocks of complex life. And just as fortunately, the same laws of physics provide for just enough non-equilibrium in the world so that algorithmic processes can jumpstart themselves, eventually discovering those macromolecules and turning them into tools for another wave of exploration and discovery. Thank God for those laws. Well, shouldn't we? If the laws were any different, we have just heard, the tree of life might never have sprung up. We may have figured out a way of excusing God from the task of designing the replication machinery system, which can design itself automatically if any of the theories discussed in the previous section are right or on the right track. But even if we concede that this is so, we still have the stupendous fact that the laws do permit this wonderful unfolding to happen. And that has been quite enough to inspire many people to surmise that the intelligence of the Creator is the wisdom of the lawgiver instead of the ingenuity of the engineer. When Darwin entertains the idea that the laws of nature are designed by God, he has distinguished company, past and present. Newton insisted that the original arrangement of the universe was inexplicable by mere natural causes and could only be ascribed to the counsel and contrivance of a voluntary agent. Einstein spoke of the laws of nature as the secrets of the Old One and famously expressed his disbelief in the role of chance in quantum mechanics by proclaiming, "Gott würfelt nicht," God does not play dice. More recently, the astronomer Fred Hoyle has said, "I do not believe that any scientist who examined the evidence would fail to draw the inference that the laws of nuclear physics have been deliberately designed with regard to the consequences they produce inside the stars." Quoted in Barrow and Tipler, 1988, page 22. The physicist and cosmologist Freeman Dyson puts the point much more cautiously. "I do not claim that the architecture of the universe proves the existence of God. I claim only that the architecture of the universe is consistent with the hypothesis that mind plays an essential role in its functioning." Dyson, 1979, page 251. Darwin himself was prepared to propose an honorable truce at this point, but Darwinian thinking carries on with a momentum created by the success of its earlier applications to the same issue in other contexts. As more and more has been learned about the development of the universe since the Big Bang, about the conditions that permitted the formation of galaxies and stars and the heavy elements from which planets can be formed, physicists and cosmologists have been more and more struck by the exquisite sensitivity of the laws of nature. The speed of light is approximately 186,000 miles per second. What if it were only 185,000 miles per second or 187,000 miles per second? Would that change much of anything? What if the force of gravity were 1% more or less than it is? The fundamental constants of physics, the speed of light, the constant of gravitational attraction, the weak and strong forces of subatomic interaction, Planck's constant, have values that of course permit the actual development of the universe as we know it to have happened. But it turns out that if, in imagination, we change any of these values by just the tiniest amount, we thereby posit a universe in which none of this could have happened, and indeed in which apparently nothing lifelike could ever have emerged. No planets, no atmospheres, no solids at all, no elements except hydrogen and helium, or maybe not even that. Just some boring plasma of hot, undifferentiated stuff or an equally boring nothingness. So isn't it a wonderful fact that the laws are just right for us to exist? Indeed, one might want to add, we almost didn't make it. Is this wonderful fact something that needs an explanation? And if so, what kind of explanation might it receive? According to the anthropic principle, we are entitled to infer facts about the universe and its laws from the undisputed fact that we, the anthropoi, we human beings, are here to do the inferring and observing. The anthropic principle comes in several flavors. Among the useful recent books is Barrow and Tipler, 1988, and Brewer, 1991. See also Pagels, 1985, Gardner, 1986. In the weak form, it is a sound, harmless, and on occasion, useful application of elementary logic. If X is a necessary condition for the existence of Y, and Y exists, then X exists. If consciousness depends on complex physical structures, and complex structures depend on large molecules composed of elements heavier than hydrogen and helium, then, since we are conscious, the world must contain such elements. But notice that there is a loose cannon on the deck in the previous sentence. The wandering must. I have followed the common practice in ordinary English of couching a claim of necessity in a technically incorrect way. As any student in logic class soon learns, what I really should have written is, it must be the case that, if consciousness depends, then, since we are conscious, the world contains such elements. The conclusion that can be validly drawn is only that the world does contain such elements, not that it had to contain such elements. It has to contain such elements for us to exist, we may grant. But it might not have contained such elements, and if that had been the case, we wouldn't be here to be dismayed. It's as simple as that. Some attempts to define and defend a strong form of the anthropic principle strive to justify the late location of the must as not casual expression but a conclusion about the way the universe necessarily is. I admit that I find it hard to believe that so much confusion and controversy are actually generated by a simple mistake of logic. But the evidence is really quite strong that this is often the case, and not just in discussions of the anthropic principle. Consider the related confusions that surround Darwinian deduction in general. Darwin deduces that human beings must have evolved from a common ancestor of the chimpanzee, or that all life must have arisen from a single beginning, and some people, unaccountably, take these deductions as claims that human beings are somehow a necessary product of evolution, or that life is a necessary feature of our planet. But nothing of the kind follows from Darwin's deductions, properly construed. What must be the case is not that we are here, but that since we are here, we evolved from primates. Suppose John is a bachelor, then he must be single, right? That's a truth of logic. Poor John, he can never get married. The fallacy is obvious in this example, and it is worth keeping it in the back of your mind as a template to compare other arguments with. Believers in any of the proposed strong versions of the anthropic principle think they can deduce something wonderful and surprising from the fact that we conscious observers are here. For instance, that in some sense the universe exists for us, or perhaps that we exist so that the universe as a whole can exist, or even that God created the universe the way he did so that we would be possible. Construed in this way, these proposals are attempts to restore Paley's argument from design, readdressing it to the design of the universe's most general laws of physics, not the particular constructions those laws make possible. Here, once again, Darwinian countermoves are available. These are deep waters, and most of the discussions of the issues wallow in technicalities. But the logical force of these Darwinian responses can be brought out vividly by considering a much simpler case. First, I must introduce you to the game of life. A nifty meme whose principal author is the mathematician John Horton Conway. I will be putting this valuable thinking tool to several more uses as we go along. This game does an excellent job of taking in a complicated issue and reflecting back only the dead simple essence or skeleton of the issue, ready to be understood and appreciated. Life is played on a two-dimensional grid, such as a checkerboard, using simple counters such as pebbles or pennies, or one could go high-tech and play it on a computer screen. It is not a game one plays to win. If it is a game at all, it is solitaire. The grid divides space into square cells, and each cell is either on or off at each moment. If it is on, place a penny on the square. If it is off, leave the square empty. Notice in Figure 7.2, in the downloadable PDF, that each cell has eight neighbors. The four adjacent cells, north, south, east, and west, and the four diagonals, northeast, southeast, southwest, and northwest. Time in the life world is discrete, not continuous. It advances in ticks, and the state of the world changes between each two ticks according to the following rule. Life physics. For each cell in the grid, count how many of its eight neighbors are on at the present instant. If the answer is exactly two, the cell stays in its present state, on or off, in the next instant. If the answer is exactly three, the cell is on in the next instant, whatever its current state. Under all other conditions, the cell is off. That's it. That's the only rule of the game. You now know all there is to know about how to play life. The entire physics of the life world is captured in that single, unexceptioned law. Although this is the fundamental law of the physics of the life world, it helps at first to conceive this curious physics in biological terms. Think of cells going on as births, cells going off as deaths, and succeeding instants as generations. Either overcrowding, more than three inhabited neighbors, or isolation, fewer than two inhabited neighbors, leads to death. Consider a few simple cases. In the configuration in Figure 7.3, only cells D and F each have exactly three neighbors on, so they will be the only birth cells in the next generation. Cells B and H each have only one neighbor on, so they die in the next generation. Cell E has two neighbors on, so it stays on. Thus, the next instant will be the configuration shown in Figure 7.4, also available in the PDF. Obviously, the configuration will revert back in the next instant, and this little pattern will flip-flop back and forth indefinitely, unless some new on cells are brought into the picture somehow. It is called a flasher or traffic light. What will happen to the configuration in Figure 7.5? See the PDF. Nothing. Each on cell has three neighbors on, so it is reborn just as it is. No off cell has three neighbors on, so no other births happen. This configuration is called a still life. By the scrupulous application of our single law, one can predict with perfect accuracy the next instant of any configuration of on and off cells, and the instant after that, and so forth. In other words, the life world is a toy world that perfectly instantiates the determinism made famous by Laplace. If we are given the state description of this world at an instant, we observers can perfectly predict the future instance by the simple application of our one law of physics. Or in the terms I have developed in earlier writings, in 1971, 1978, 1987b, when we adopt the physical stance towards a configuration in the life world, our powers of prediction are perfect. There is no noise, no uncertainty, no probability less than one. Moreover, It follows from the two-dimensionality of the life world that nothing is hidden from view. There is no backstage. There are no hidden variables. The unfolding of the physics of objects in the life world is directly and completely visible. If you find following the simple rule a tedious exercise, there are computer simulations of the life world in which you can set up configurations on the screen and let the computer execute the algorithm for you, changing the configuration again and again according to the single rule. In the best simulations, one can change the scale of both time and space, alternating between close-up and bird's-eye view. A nice touch added to some color versions is that on cells, often just called pixels, are color-coded by their age. They are born blue, let us say, and then change color each generation, moving through green to yellow to orange to red to brown to black, and then staying black unless they die. This permits one to see at a glance how old certain patterns are, which cells are cogenerational, where the birth action is, and so forth. One soon discovers that some simple configurations are more interesting than others. Consider a diagonal line segment. It is not a flasher. Each generation, its two end-on cells die of isolation, and there are no birth cells. The whole segment soon evaporates. In addition to the configurations that never change, the still lifes, and those that evaporate entirely, such as the diagonal line segment, there are configurations with all manner of periodicity. The flasher, we discussed, has a two-generation period that continues ad infinitum, unless some other configuration encroaches. Encroachment is what makes life interesting. Among the periodic configurations are some that swim, amoeba-like, across the plane. The simplest is the glider, the five-pixel configuration shown taking a single stroke to the southeast. Then there are the eaters, puffer trains, space rakes, and a host of other aptly named denizens of the life world that emerge as recognizable objects at a new level. This level is analogous to what in earlier work I have called the design level. This level has its own language, a transparent foreshortening of the tedious descriptions one could give at the physical level. For instance, an eater can eat a glider in four generations. Whatever is being consumed, the basic process is the same. A bridge forms between the eater and its prey. In the next generation, the bridge region dies from overpopulation, taking a bite out of both eater and prey. The eater then repairs itself. The prey usually cannot. If the remainder of the prey dies out, as with the glider, the prey is consumed. Poundstone, 1985, page 38. Notice that something curious happens to our ontology, our catalog of what exists as we move between levels. At the physical level, there is no motion, just on and off. And the only individual things that exist, cells, are defined by their fixed spatial location. At the design level, we suddenly have the motion of persisting objects. It is one and the same glider, though composed each generation of different cells, that has moved southeast, changing shape as it moves. And there is one less glider in the world after the eater has eaten it. Notice, too, that whereas at the physical level there are absolutely no exceptions to the general law, at this level our generalizations have to be hedged. They require usually or provided nothing encroaches clauses. Stray bits of debris from earlier events can break or kill one of the objects in the ontology at this level. Their salience as real things is considerable, but not guaranteed. To say that their salience is considerable is to say that one can, with some small risk, ascend to this design level, adopt its ontology, and proceed to predict, sketchily and riskily, the behavior of larger configurations or systems of configurations without bothering to compute the physical level. For instance, one can set oneself the task of designing some interesting supersystem out of the parts that the design level makes available. This is just what Conway and his students set out to do, and they succeeded majestically. They designed and proved the viability of the design of a self-reproducing entity composed entirely of life cells that was also, for good measure, a universal Turing machine. It was a two-dimensional computer that, in principle, can compute any computable function. What on earth inspired Conway and his students to create first this world and then this amazing denizen of that world? They were trying to answer, at a very abstract level, one of the central questions we have been considering in this chapter. What is the minimal complexity required for a self-reproducing thing? They were following up the brilliant early speculations of John von Neumann, who had been working on the question at the time of his death in 1957. Francis Crick and James Watson had discovered DNA in 1953, but how it worked was a mystery for many years. Von Neumann had imagined in some detail a sort of floating robot that picked up pieces of flotsam and jetsam that could be used to build a duplicate of itself that would then be able to repeat the process. His description, posthumously published in 1966, of how an automaton would read its own blueprint and then copy it into its new creation, anticipated in impressive detail many of the later discoveries about the mechanisms of DNA expression and replication. But in order to make his proof of the possibility of a self-reproducing automaton mathematically rigorous and tractable, von Neumann had switched to simple, two-dimensional abstractions, now known as cellular automata. Conway's life world cells are a particularly agreeable example of cellular automata. Conway and his students wanted to confirm von Neumann's proof in detail by actually constructing a two-dimensional world with a simple physics, in which such a self-replicating construction would be a stable, working structure. Like von Neumann, they wanted their answer to be as general as possible, and hence as independent as possible of actual, earthly, local, physics, and chemistry. They wanted something dead simple, easy to visualize, and easy to calculate. So they not only dropped from three dimensions to two, they also digitized both space and time. All times and distances, as we saw, are in whole numbers of instants and cells. It was von Neumann who had taken Alan Turing's abstract conception of a mechanical computer, now called a Turing machine, and engineered it into the specification for a general-purpose, stored-program, serial-processing computer, now called a von Neumann machine. In his brilliant explorations of the spatial and structured requirements for such a computer, he had realized and proved that a universal Turing machine that can compute any computable function at all, could, in principle, be built in a two-dimensional world. Conway and his students also set out to confirm this with their own exercise in two-dimensional engineering. It was far from easy, but they showed how they could build a working computer out of simpler life forms. Glider streams can provide the input-output tape, for instance, and the tape reader can be some huge assembly of eaters, gliders, and other bits and pieces. What does this machine look like? Poundstone calculates that the whole construction would be on the order of 10 to the 13th power cells, or pixels. Displaying a 10 to the 13th power pixel pattern would require a video screen about 3 million pixels across, at least. Assume the pixels are 1 millimeter square, which is very high resolution by the standards of home computers, then the screen would have to be 3 kilometers, about 2 miles, across. It would have an area about 6 times that of Monaco. Perspective would shrink the pixels of a self-reproducing pattern to invisibility. If you got far enough away from the screen so that the entire pattern was comfortably in view, the pixels, and even the gliders, eaters, and guns would be too tiny to make out. A self-reproducing pattern would be a hazy glow, like a galaxy. Poundstone, 1985, pages 227 to 28. In other words, by the time you have built up enough pieces into something that can reproduce itself in a two-dimensional world, it is roughly as much larger than its smallest bits as an organism is larger than its atoms. You probably can't do it with anything much less complicated, though this has not been strictly proven. The hunch with which we began this chapter gets dramatic support. It takes a lot of design work, the work done by Conway and his students, to turn available bits and pieces into a self-replicating thing. Self-replicators don't just fall together in cosmic coincidences. They are too large and expensive. The game of life illustrates many important principles and can be used to construct many different arguments or thought experiments. But I will content myself here with just two points that are particularly relevant to this stage in our argument before turning to my main point. For further reflections on life and its implications, see Dennett, 1991b. First, notice how the distinction between order and design gets blurred here, just as it did for Hume. Conway designed the whole life world. That is, he set out to articulate an order that would function in a certain way. But do gliders, for instance, count as designed things, or as just natural objects, like atoms or molecules? Surely the tape reader Conway and his students cobbled together out of gliders and the like is a designed object. But the simplest glider would seem just to fall out of the basic physics of the life world automatically. Nobody had to design or invent the glider. It just was discovered to be implied by the physics of the life world. But that, of course, is actually true of everything in the life world. Nothing happens in the life world that isn't strictly implied, logically deducible by straightforward theorem proving, by the physics and the initial configuration of cells. Some of the things in the life world are just more marvelous and unanticipated by us with our puny intellects than others. There is a sense in which the Conway self-reproducing pixel galaxy is just one more life macromolecule with a very long and complicated periodicity in its behavior. What if we set in motion a huge herd of these self-reproducers and let them compete for resources? And suppose they then evolved, that is, their descendants were not exact duplicates of them. Would these descendants have a greater claim to having been designed? Perhaps. But there is no line to be drawn between merely ordered things and designed things. The engineer starts with some objets trouvés, found objects with properties that can be harnessed in larger constructions. But the differences between a designed and manufactured nail, a sawn plank, and a naturally occurring slab of slate are not principled. Seagull wings are great lifters. Hemoglobin macromolecules are superb transporting machines. Glucose molecules are nifty energy packets. And carbon atoms are outstanding all-purpose stick'em binders. The second point is that life is an excellent illustration of the power, and an attendant weakness, of computer simulations addressed to scientific questions. It used to be that the only way to persuade oneself of very abstract generalizations was to prove them rigorously from the fundamental principles or axioms of whatever theory one had. Mathematics, physics, chemistry, economics. Earlier in this century, it was beginning to become clear that many of the theoretical calculations one would like to make in these sciences were simply beyond human capacity, intractable. Then the computer came along to provide a new way of addressing such questions. Massive simulations. Simulation of the weather is the example familiar to all of us from watching television meteorologists. But computer simulation is also revolutionizing how science is conducted in many other fields. Probably the most important, epistemological advance in scientific method since the invention of accurate timekeeping devices. In evolutionary theory, the new discipline of artificial life has recently sprung up to provide a name and an umbrella to cover a veritable gold rush of researchers at different levels, from the submolecular to the ecological. Even among those researchers who have not taken up the banner of artificial life, however, there is general acknowledgement that most of their theoretical research on evolution, most of the recent work discussed in this audiobook, for instance, would have been simply unthinkable without computer simulations to test, to confirm or disconfirm, the intuitions of the theoreticians. Indeed, as we have talked about, the very idea of evolution as an algorithmic process could not be properly formulated and evaluated until it was possible to test huge, complicated algorithmic models in place of the wildly oversimple models of earlier theorists. Now, some scientific problems are not amenable to solution by simulation, and others are probably only amenable to solution by simulation, but in between, there are problems that can, in principle, be addressed in two different ways, reminiscent of the two different ways of solving the train problem given to von Neumann: a deep way via theory and a shallow way via brute force simulation and inspection. It would be a shame if the many undeniable attractions of simulated worlds drowned out our aspirations to understand these phenomena in the deep ways of theory. I spoke with Conway once about the creation of the game of life, and he lamented the fact that explorations of the life world were now almost exclusively by empirical methods. Setting up all the variations of interest on a computer and letting her rip to see what happens. Not only did this usually shield one from even the opportunity of devising a strict proof of what one found, but, he noted, people using computer simulations are typically insufficiently patient. They try out combinations and watch them for 15 or 20 minutes, and if nothing of interest has happened, they abandon them, marking them as avenues already explored and found barren. This myopic style of exploration risks closing off important avenues of research prematurely. It is an occupational hazard of all computer simulators, and it is simply their high-tech version of the philosopher's fundamental foible, mistaking a failure of imagination for an insight into necessity. A prosthetically enhanced imagination is still liable to failure, especially if it is not used with sufficient rigor. But now it is time for my main point. When Conway and his students first set out to create a two-dimensional world in which interesting things would happen, they found that nothing seemed to work. It took more than a year for this industrious and ingenious group of intelligent searchers to find the simple life physics rule in the vast space of possible simple rules. All the obvious variations turned out to be hopeless. To get some sense of this, try altering the constants for birth and death, change the birth rule from 3 to 4, for instance, and see what happens. The worlds these variations govern either freeze up solid in no time or evaporate into nothingness in no time. Conway and his students wanted a world in which growth was possible, but not too explosive, in which things, higher order patterns of cells, could move and change but also retain their identity over time. And of course, it had to be a world in which structures could do things of interest, like eat or make tracks or repel things. Of all the imaginable two-dimensional worlds, so far as Conway knows, there is only one that meets these desiderata: the life world. In any event, the variations that have been checked in subsequent years have never come close to measuring up to Conway's in terms of interest, simplicity, fecundity, elegance. The life world might indeed be the best of all possible two-dimensional worlds. Now suppose that some self-reproducing universal Turing machines in the life world were to have a conversation with each other about the world as they found it, with its wonderfully simple physics, expressible in a single sentence and covering all eventualities. They would be committing a logical howler if they argued that since they existed, the life world, with its particular physics, had to exist. For after all, Conway might have decided to be a plumber or play bridge instead of hunting for this world. But what if they deduced that their world was just too wonderful, with its elegant, life-sustaining physics, to have come into existence without an intelligent creator? If they jumped to the conclusion that they owed their existence to the activities of a wise lawgiver, they'd be right. There is a God, and his name is Conway. But they would be jumping to a conclusion. The existence of a universe obeying a set of laws even as elegant as the life law, or the laws of our own physics, does not logically require an intelligent lawgiver. Notice first how the actual history of the game of life divided the intellectual labor in two. On the one hand, there was the initial exploratory work that led to the physical law promulgated by the lawgiver. And on the other hand, there was the engineering work of the law exploiters, the artificers. These might have happened in that temporal order. First, Conway, in a stroke of inspired genius, promulgates the physics of the life world, and then he and his students design and build the wonderful denizens of that world according to the law laid down. But in fact, the two tasks were intermixed. Many trial and error attempts to make things that were interesting provided the guidance for Conway's legislative search. Notice, second, that this postulated division of labor illustrates a fundamental Darwinian theme from the previous chapter. The task of the wise God required to put this world into motion is a task of discovery, not creation, a job for a Newton, not a Shakespeare. What Newton found, and what Conway found, are eternal Platonic fixed points that anybody else, in principle, could have discovered. Not idiosyncratic creations that depend in any way on the particularities of the minds of their authors. If Conway had never turned his hand to designing cellular automata worlds, if Conway had never even existed, some other mathematician might very well have hit upon exactly the life world that Conway gets the credit for. So, as we follow the Darwinian down this path, God the artificer turns first into God the lawgiver, who now can be seen to merge with God the lawfinder. God's hypothesized contribution is thereby becoming less personal, and hence more readily performable by something dogged and mindless. Hume has already shown us how the argument runs, and now, bolstered by our experience with Darwinian thinking in more familiar terrain, we can extrapolate a positive Darwinian alternative to the hypothesis that our laws are a gift from God. What would the Darwinian alternative have to be? That there has been an evolution of worlds, in the sense of the whole universes, and the world we find ourselves in is simply one among countless others that have existed through eternity. There are two quite different ways of thinking about the evolution of laws, one of them stronger, more Darwinian than the other, in that it involves something like natural selection. Might it be that there has been some sort of differential reproduction of universes, with some varieties having more offspring than others? Hume's Philo toyed with this idea, as we discussed in Chapter 1. And what surprise must we entertain when we find him a stupid mechanic, who imitated others and copied an art which, through a long succession of ages, after multiplied trials, mistakes, corrections, deliberations, and controversies, had been gradually improving. Many worlds might have been botched and bungled throughout an eternity ere this system was struck out, much labor lost. many fruitless trials made, and a slow but continued improvement carried on during infinite ages of world-making. Part 5. Hume imputes the continued improvement to the minimal selective bias of a stupid mechanic. But we can replace the stupid mechanic with something even stupider without dissipating the lifting power. A purely algorithmic Darwinian process of world-trying. Though Hume obviously didn't think this was anything but an amusing philosophical fantasy, the idea has recently been developed in some detail by the physicist Lee Smolin, 1992. The basic idea is that the singularities known as black holes are in effect the birthplaces of offspring universes, in which the fundamental physical constants would differ slightly in random ways from the physical constants in the parent universe. So, according to Smolin's hypothesis, we have both differential reproduction and mutation, the two essential features of any Darwinian selection algorithm. Those universes that just happen to have physical constants that encourage the development of black holes would, ipso facto, have more offspring, which would have more offspring, and so forth. That's the selection step. Note that there is no grim reaper of universes in this scenario. They all live and die in due course, but some merely have more offspring. According to this idea, then, it is no mere interesting coincidence that we live in a universe in which there are black holes, nor is it an absolute logical necessity. It is rather the sort of conditional near necessity you find in any evolutionary account. The link, Smolin claims, is carbon, which plays a role both in the collapse of gaseous clouds, or in other words, the birth of stars, a precursor to the birth of black holes, and, of course, in our molecular engineering. Is the theory testable? Smolin offers some predictions that would, if disconfirmed, pretty well eliminate his idea. It should be the case that all the near variations in physical constants from the values we enjoy should yield universes in which black holes are less probable or less frequent than in our own. In short, he thinks our universe should manifest at least a local, if not global, optimum in the black hole-making competition. The trouble is that there are too few constraints, so far as I can see, on what should count as a near variation and why, but perhaps further elaboration on the theory will clarify this. Needless to say, it is hard to know what to make of this idea yet, but whatever the eventual verdict of scientists, the idea already serves to secure a philosophical point. Freeman Dyson and Fred Hoyle, among many others, think they see a wonderful pattern in the laws of physics. If they or anyone else were to make the tactical mistake of asking the rhetorical question, "What else but God could possibly explain it?" Smolin would have a nicely deflating reply. I advise my philosophy students to develop hypersensitivity for rhetorical questions in philosophy. They paper over whatever cracks there are in the arguments. But suppose, for the sake of argument, that Smolin's speculations are all flawed. Suppose selection of universes doesn't work after all. There is a weaker, semi-Darwinian speculation that also answers the rhetorical question handily. Hume toyed with this weaker idea too, as we already noted in Part 8 of his dialogues. Instead of supposing matter infinite, as Epicurus did, let us suppose it finite. A finite number of particles is only susceptible of finite transpositions, and it must happen in an eternal duration that every possible order or position must be tried an infinite number of times. Suppose that matter were thrown into any position by a blind, unguided force. It is evident that this first position must, in all probability, be the most confused and most disorderly imaginable, without any resemblance to those works of human contrivance which, along with a symmetry of parts, discover an adjustment of means to ends and a tendency to self-preservation. Suppose that the actuating force, whatever it be, still continues in matter. Thus, the universe goes on for many ages in a continued succession of chaos and disorder. But is it not possible that it may settle at last? May we not hope for such a position, or rather be assured of it, from the eternal revolutions of unguided matter? And may not this account for all the appearing wisdom and contrivance which is in the universe? This idea exploits no version of selection at all, but simply draws attention to the fact that we have eternity to play with. There is no 5 billion year deadline in this instance, the way there is for the evolution of life on Earth. As we noted in our consideration of the libraries of Babel and Mendel, we need reproduction and selection if we are to traverse vast spaces in non-vast amounts of time. But when time is no longer a limiting consideration, selection is no longer a requirement. In the course of eternity, you can go everywhere in the library of Babel or the library of Mendel or the library of Einstein, all possible values of all the constants of physics, as long as you keep moving. Hume imagines an actuating force to keep the shuffling going, and this reminds us of Locke's argument about matter without motion. But it does not suppose that the actuating force has any intelligence at all. In fact, if you shuffle through all the possibilities for eternity, you will pass through each possible place in these vast but finite spaces not just once, but an infinity of times. Several versions of this speculation have been seriously considered by physicists and cosmologists in recent years. John Archibald Wheeler, 1974, for instance, has proposed that the universe oscillates back and forth for eternity. A big bang is followed by expansion, which is followed by contraction into a big crunch, which is followed by another big bang, and so forth, forever, with random variations in the constants and other crucial parameters occurring in each oscillation. Each possible setting is tried an infinity of times, and so every variation on every theme, both those that make sense and those that are absurd, spins itself out, not once, but an infinity of times. It is hard to believe that this idea is empirically testable in any meaningful way, but we should reserve judgment. Variations or elaborations on the theme just might have implications that could be confirmed or disconfirmed. In the meantime, it is worth noting that this family of hypotheses does have the virtue of extending the principles of explanation that work so well in testable domains all the way out. Consistency and simplicity are in its favor. And that, once again, is certainly enough to blunt the appeal of the traditional alternative. Anybody who won a coin-tossing tournament would be tempted to think he was blessed with magical powers, especially if he had no direct knowledge of the other players. Suppose you were to create a 10-round coin-tossing tournament without letting each of the 1,024 contestants realize he was entered in a tournament. You say to each one as you recruit him, "Congratulations, my friend, I am Mephistopheles, and I am going to bestow great powers on you. With me at your side, you are going to win 10 consecutive coin tosses without a loss." You then arrange for your dupes to meet, pairwise, until you have a final winner. You never let the contestants discuss your relation to them, and you kiss off the 1,023 losers along the way with some sotto voce jibe to the effect that they were pretty gullible to believe your claim about being Mephistopheles. The winner, and there must be one, will certainly have been given evidence of being a chosen one. But if he falls for it, this is simply an illusion of what we might call retrospective myopia. The winner doesn't see that the situation was structured so that somebody simply had to be the lucky one, and he just happened to be it. Now, if the universe were structured in such a way that an infinity of different laws of physics got tried out in the fullness of time, We would be succumbing to the same temptation were we to draw any conclusions about the laws of nature being prepared especially for us. This is not an argument for the conclusion that the universe is or must be so structured, but just for the more modest conclusion that no feature of the observable laws of nature could be invulnerable to this alternative, deflationary interpretation. Once these ever more speculative, ever more attenuated Darwinian hypotheses are formulated, they serve, in classic Darwinian fashion, to diminish, by small steps, the explanatory task facing us. All that is left over in need of explanation at this point is a certain perceived elegance or wonderfulness in the observed laws of physics. If you doubt that the hypothesis of an infinity of variant universes could actually explain this elegance, you should reflect that this has at least as much claim to being a non-question-begging explanation as any traditional alternative. By the time God has been depersonalized to the point of being some abstract and timeless principle of beauty or goodness, it is hard to see how the existence of God could explain anything. What would be asserted by the explanation that was not already given in the description of the wonderful phenomenon to be explained? Darwin began his attack on the cosmic pyramid in the middle. Give me order and time, and I will explain design. We have now discussed how the downward path of universal acid flows. If we give his successors chaos, in the old-fashioned sense of pure meaningless randomness, and eternity, they will explain order, the very order needed to account for the design. Does utter chaos in turn need an explanation? What is there left to explain? Some people think there is still one leftover why question. Why is there something rather than nothing? Opinions differ on whether the question makes any intelligible demand at all. If it does, the answer, because God exists, is probably as good an answer as any. But look at its competition. Why not? 4. Eternal recurrence. Life without foundations. Science is wonderful at destroying metaphysical answers, but incapable of providing substitute ones. Science takes away foundations without providing a replacement. Whether we want to be there or not, science has put us in a position of having to live without foundations. It was shocking when Nietzsche said this, but today it is commonplace. Our historical position, and no end to it is in sight, is that of having to philosophize without foundations. Hilary Putnam, 1987, page 29. The sense that the meaning of the universe had evaporated was what seemed to escape those who welcomed Darwin as a benefactor of mankind. Nietzsche considered that evolution presented a correct picture of the world, but that it was a disastrous picture. His philosophy was an attempt to produce a new world picture which took Darwinism into account, but was not nullified by it. R.J. Hollingdale, 1965, page 90. In the wake of Darwin's publication of Origin of Species, Friedrich Nietzsche rediscovered what Hume had already toyed with, the idea that an eternal recurrence of blind, meaningless variation, chaotic, pointless shuffling of matter and law, would inevitably spew up worlds whose evolution through time would yield the apparently meaningful stories of our lives. This idea of eternal recurrence became a cornerstone of his nihilism, and thus part of the foundation of what became existentialism. The idea that what is happening now has all happened before must be as old as the déjà vu phenomenon that so often inspires superstitious versions of it. Cyclical cosmogonies are not uncommon in the catalog of human cultures. But when Nietzsche hit upon a version of Hume's and John Archibald Wheeler's vision, he took it to be much more than an amusing thought experiment or an elaboration of ancient superstitions. He thought, at least for a while, He had stumbled upon a scientific proof of the greatest importance. I suspect that Nietzsche was encouraged to take the idea more seriously than Hume had done by his dim appreciation of the tremendous power of Darwinian thinking. Nietzsche's references to Darwin are almost all hostile. But there are quite a few, and that in itself supports Walter Kaufmann's argument, 1950, in the preface, that Nietzsche was not a Darwinist, but only aroused from his dogmatic slumber by Darwin, much as Kant was a century earlier by Hume. Nietzsche's references to Darwin also reveal that his acquaintance with Darwin's ideas was beset with common misrepresentations and misunderstandings. So perhaps he knew Darwin primarily through the enthusiastic appropriations of the many popularizers in Germany, and indeed throughout Europe. On the few points of specific criticism he ventures, he gets Darwin utterly wrong, complaining, for instance, that Darwin has ignored the possibility of unconscious selection, when that was one of Darwin's most important bridging ideas in Origin. He refers to the complete bêtise in the Englishmen, Darwin and Wallace, and complains, "At last, confusion goes so far that one regards Darwinism as philosophy, and now the scholars and scientists dominate." Nietzsche, 1901, page 422. Others, however, regularly saw him as a Darwinian. "Other scholarly oxen have suspected me of Darwinism on this account." Nietzsche, 1989, section 3i. A label which he scoffed at, while proceeding to write in his Genealogy of Morals, 1887, one of the first and still subtlest of the Darwinian investigations of the evolution of ethics, a topic to which we will return in Chapter 16. Nietzsche viewed his argument for eternal recurrence as a proof of the absurdity or meaninglessness of life, a proof that no meaning was given to the universe from on high. And this is undoubtedly the root of the fear that many experience when encountering Darwin. So, let us examine it in Nietzsche's version, as extreme as any we are apt to find. Why exactly would eternal recurrence make life meaningless? Isn't it obvious? What if a demon were to creep after you one day or night, in your loneliest loneness, and say, "This life which you live and have lived must be lived again by you and innumerable times more, and there will be nothing new in it, but every pain and every joy and every thought and every sigh, everything unspeakably small and great in your life, must come again to you, and in the same sequence and series." Would you not throw yourself down and curse the demon who spoke to you thus? Or have you once experienced a tremendous moment in which you would answer him, "Thou art a god, and never have I heard anything more divine"? The Gay Science, 1882, page 341, passage translated in Danto, 1965, page 210. Is this message liberating or horrifying? Nietzsche couldn't seem to make up his own mind. Perhaps because he often chose to clothe the implications of his most scientific of hypotheses in these rather mystical trappings. We can get a little fresh air into the discussion by considering a delectable parody version by the novelist Tom Robbins in Even Cowgirls Get the Blues. For Christmas that year, Julian gave Sissy a miniature Tyrolean village. The craftsmanship was remarkable. There was a tiny cathedral whose stained glass windows made fruit salad of sunlight. There was a plaza and ein Biergarten. The Biergarten got quite noisy on Saturday nights. There was a bakery that smelled always of hot bread and strudel. There was a town hall and a police station with cutaway sections that revealed standard amounts of red tape and corruption. There were little Tyroleans in leather breeches, intricately stitched, and beneath the breeches, genitalia of equally fine workmanship. There were ski shops and many other interesting things, including an orphanage. The orphanage was designed to catch fire and burn down every Christmas Eve. Orphans would dash into the snow with their nightgowns blazing. Terrible. Around the second week of January, a fire inspector would come and poke through the ruins, muttering, "If they had only listened to me, those children would be alive today." Robbins, 1976, pages 191 to 192. The craftsmanship of this passage is itself remarkable. The repetition of the orphanage drama year after year seems to rob the little world of any real meaning. But why? Why exactly should it be the repetition of the fire inspector's lament that makes it sound so hollow? Perhaps if we looked closely at what that entails, we would find the sleight of hand that makes the passage work. Do the little Tyroleans rebuild the orphanage themselves? Or is there a reset button on this miniature village? What difference would that make? Well, where do the new orphans come from? Do the dead ones come back to life? Dennett, 1984, pages 9 through 10. Notice that Robbins says that the orphanage was designed to catch fire and burn down every Christmas Eve. The creator of this miniature world is clearly taunting us, ridiculing the seriousness with which we face our life problems. The moral seems clear. If the meaning of this drama must come from on high, from a creator, it would be an obscene joke, a trivialization of the strivings of the individuals in that world. But what if the meaning is somehow the creation of the individuals themselves, arising anew in each incarnation rather than as a gift from on high? This might open up the possibility of meaning that was not threatened by repetition. This is the defining theme of existentialism in its various species. The only meaning there can be is the meaning you somehow create for yourself. How that trick might be accomplished has always been something of a mystery among existentialists. But as we shall soon talk about, Darwinism does have some demystification to offer in its account of the process of meaning creation. The key, once again, is the abandonment of John Locke's mind-first vision and its replacement with a vision in which importance itself, like everything else that we treasure, gradually evolves from nothingness. We might pause before turning to some of these details to consider where our roundabout journey has brought us so far. We began with a somewhat childish vision of an anthropomorphic handicrafter god, and recognized that this idea